Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent, and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher. Shane's not here because this time I'm in California. I'm at the University of California, Irvine. I'm with Abby Reyes, who is the director of the Sustainability Initiative for the University of California, Irvine. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's start with a big question then. What does the director of the Sustainability Initiative do?
We work to make community-engaged sustainability scholarship and practice integral to UC Irvine's excellence as a research, teaching, and service campus. And we do that so that our students and faculty and staff have the tools, the training, the resources they need to take bigger roles in addressing the critical sustainability challenges in our region and across the globe. We're doing that because the University of California, which is a 10-campus system of which we are one campus, has a drive, has a purpose right now to accelerate the shifts we need to see to decarbonize the university and to accelerate the shifts in other areas of our lives, to reorganize how we relate to the planet and each other. So our work falls in the academic realm. I have colleagues who work in parallel to me who are taking care of the campus physical plant. Our initiative involves faculty, students and staff who work in the areas of research, education inside and outside the classroom, community engagement, and philanthropy. So our projects are things like building flood resilience in coastal communities here right next to us in the community of Newport Beach and down at the border in communities on the South San Diego side of the U.S.-Mexico border and in the Mexico side in Tijuana right up next to the border. There are flood resilience issues that affect these communities differently, and our teams of engineers, social ecologists, and community engagement experts are working together with the support of the National Science Foundation, for example, to address this hyper-local setting to contribute to our global understanding and application of how we build coastal community resilience. We're also doing similar work in an extreme environment out in the desert communities anchored around our one of the crown jewels in our state park system in the Anza-Borrego desert region where it sounds like you just were recently. We have a desert research station there, and our faculty members from ecology and anthropology and other disciplines have been working together with community groups there and have formed a sustainability stewardship council comprised of key community players from all walks of life who are reimagining their economy and tackling the big questions that we face here in the state of California as we are in our fourth year of the most major drought in recorded history for our state. They're tackling the questions of what do we do now that we can see that our groundwater is depleting in the way that it is, and now that we see we aren't getting the allocations where we historically have been able to get from our river systems. What do we need to do to reorganize ourselves and our economy to continue living in this extreme environment? We do that kind of work with students, faculty, and staff. in several different communities. Those are two examples. But the most exciting part of our work that keeps me going is that we do what we call sustainability leadership training with young people. And that is an umbrella term that we use to describe a new set of skills that we believe the rising generation of sustainability leaders needs to be able to be the knowledge brokers between communities and academics and policy and funders, and to be able to have the interpersonal skill and personal mastery to work together across traditional divides on these cross-cutting issues, where what can make or break progress is how well people relate to each other and how outside of our own positions we can move in order to get to our underlying interests, which are more often than not common about what kind of future we want to see for our families and our extended communities and our planet. So that work falls in the realm of transformational leadership development, and we do that with our UC Irvine students, many of whom are first-generation college students, many of whom come from first-generation immigrant families. And the model of the training that we use is a model that I was fortunate enough to learn when I was a very young person, and which made its way all the way across to Australia and New Zealand. A teacher of mine, Fran Peavy, who was a social change worker from San Francisco, spent a lot of time in Australia and New Zealand in the Heart Politics movement there, developing a methodology that we call strategic questioning, which is a form of inquiry that we teach young people to enable young people to lead processes in their communities, to move all the way from, you know, focusing in on what's concerning us most, through to what do we want to see instead, through to what needs to change to get there, and then designing action for change. And this is, it's a very simple methodology that young people have taken up around the globe, perfected in many ways in Central America. And so given our location, geographic location here at Irvine, which is close to the U.S.-Mexico border, we are utilizing the skills and expertise of young people in Central America to teach our students this skill set, and then we deploy our students to work with high school students and high school science teachers in some of these communities I have described as living on kind of the front lines of the changing climate here in our region.
That's quite a big job.
Well, that's, and it's only part of it. It's very exciting, but the other role that I play is that right now the University of California president, Janet Napolitano, has created a carbon neutrality initiative. The goal of the initiative is to make the University of California 10-campus system carbon neutral by 2025, which is a more aggressive goal than we've been under before. Part of that initiative is, of course, you know, the workings of the physical campus plants. But the initiative also is guided by a Global Climate Leadership Council, one arm of which is faculty education and engagement. I'm the co-chair of that group of faculty from all 10 campuses, and we have in the last 6 months mobilized around three quick wins, which include we're creating a system-wide climate education gateway, which our colleagues at this conference we are attending today through the RISCIT organization, the Center for Research on Sustainability, Collapse Preparedness, and IT, are convening for our entire 10 campuses. The Climate Education Gateway is a designed to be a resource populated by and used by University of California faculty members in order to distribute better the deep expertise we have in climate change, to distribute it better among faculty who may not have that expertise but who want to integrate climate and sustainability into their existing coursework. And that's one project coming out of the system. The second is that we've enacted a new award for a faculty climate action champion so that each campus can funnel resources and attention into the new work of an engaged faculty member who is coming up with new ways of integrating research, education, and community engagement focused on climate. And the third is that we are initiating a year's worth of deep training for our faculty who participate on a volunteer basis to learn and share skills about infusing existing curriculum, regardless of discipline, with the concepts of sustainability and climate. We have the target of making sustainability and climate education part of the curricular and or other educational experience of all 250,000 UC students by the year 2020. It feels too far away for me. I want it now. But we're getting there through these three quick win solutions now, looking at longer term and deeper projects going forward.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up right outside of the Washington, D.C. Beltway in Virginia, near the Shenandoah River Valley.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be I wanted to run a popular education resource center with adult ed with communities that were trying to figure out better ways of relating to their environments.
Where did that come from?
My mother raised us with an ethic of service and conservation. I think she had us in a little club called the Tree Huggers when we were four. I can remember the picture from it and the art projects from it. She was one of the people who helped me understand from an early age that service is the path to freedom to liberation in the spiritual sense, that the path of selfless service is a way to be closer to one's true self. And so I just have that as my ethic. And it has been fruitful to work from that place because we have been able to draw people to this work who similarly work from that spirit of knowing that what we're doing is, you know, is offered in a gesture of creativity and joy and not a lot of attachment to the outcome. Very, very focused on, you know, getting to our desired outcomes and outputs, but also not attached.
Offered in a spirit of joy, when we're talking about sustainability, there's some pretty big bad news. Do you front load with that stuff or do you skip over it? How do you deal with that?
Well, in our trainings, for example, with young people, when we're doing the trainings with folks who are in formal education here, you know, kids who are 18, 19, 20, 21, many of them are students in the global sustainability curriculum here. So they are definitely understanding in the classroom the scale and pace of the deterioration of our critical life support systems on the planet. In our trainings, which happen outside the classroom, we build community and we do a review of the pulse of the planet, which is like what they're getting in the classroom. And then we draw upon tools to enable students to express fear, emptiness, sorrow, and anger about the state of the world. And we allow that some airtime because they're not getting it in the classroom. And because our way of relating generally through social media on these issues is an online and solitary endeavor, even though it carries the illusion or the sense of being connected with others, it is often, you know, ill-processed or partially processed at best. So we give some airtime to that and then help students see that, of course, the same, you know, energy of anger is the same energy that drives passion. You know, the energy of emptiness is the same energy that enables us to work with equanimity and the letting go. The same energy of, you know, fear, it's also, the flip side of it is also hope. You know, so we help students go through that transition, and then we get into, so what are you going to do about it? So we tend to start with the doom and gloom, but not because people what we work with are hearing it for the first time, but because it's where they are, and then we move through the despair and empowerment process as elucidated by early teachers of ours, including Joanna Macy, Fran PV, and others.
What did you do when you left school?
My undergraduate studies were on conservation and community development at Stanford 20 years ago now, it turns out. Immediately after that, I received a fellowship from the Henry Luce Foundation to go to Asia to work under the mentorship there of someone doing work in the world that I wanted to do back here. So I worked for a group of human rights and environmental attorneys in the southern Philippines at Environmental Legal Assistance Center, doing rural community organizing, paralegal training, direct action with fishing and farming communities who were struggling with the adverse effects of mining, oil, gas, tourism, development. And that was a formative experience because I developed then the analysis which carries me today about the inextricable relationship between environmental and human rights and the way that if we are working for protecting the earth, we have to also be working for protecting people. And that often, you know, it's the power of the people and the power of the law together that can make real change. Or as we say here, that it's scholars and communities together enabling the shifts that we need. That work in the Philippines, you know, I was in my mid-20s. I was just cutting my teeth on what it means to be doing popular ed or to be, you know, living out in the bush, how to do that work responsibly with mentors who are coming out of a Jesuit tradition. And I when I left there, Shell and Occidental were in the middle of trying to gain access to some ancestral marine protected areas of the Tugbunwa indigenous people in the northeastern part of the island where I lived. And when I ended my fellowship and I came home to California, I went immediately to our NGO partners here who were working with communities in other parts of the world who were also getting knocks on the door by these oil giants. And in that process, I met up with those who were working with the Colombian indigenous community in northeastern Colombia who were in a long-term struggle with Occidental Petroleum, which was at that an LA-based B-rate oil company. And I started working on the UA campaign because I fell in love with Terence Freitas, who was the lead liaison between groups here in the United States and groups in Australia and Europe and this remote indigenous community in Colombia that was fighting Oxy. And in the course of that work, he and two beloved Native North American women leaders spent about a month in Uwa territory in 1999 talking with Uwa indigenous women and elders about their aspiration to build a culturally appropriate school. And on the last day of their one-month trip, they were kidnapped on their way to the airport and held for 8 days. And later, their bodies were found bound and riddled with bullets just over the Venezuelan border. So in that period in my life, in my late 20s, I had gone from, you know, bright-eyed and ready to go out of my undergraduate experience, 2 years in the Philippines cutting my teeth on what it means to be working in solidarity with integrity with indigenous communities who are fighting total David and Goliath battles against multinational oil, mining, and gas corporations. And then coming home to California and working from California in solidarity with this indigenous community in Colombia, the murders ushered me and my work into a different phase after the few years of intensive political engagement at the intergovernmental and policy level domestically here on that issue. We were able to, in concert with many, many, many other people, enable the Uwa community to get to the point of pushing Occidental out. And they left. And it doesn't mean that the Uwa struggle is over, but it does mean that the chapter closed in which they were dealing with this one company who was practicing very bad practices for the environment and human rights on the ground. And my work in that area, I went to law school. I went to law school pretty much to figure out, you know, what happened to Terrence? What do we call that? Was that a crime against humanity? Was that an extrajudicial killing? Was that a common law murder? What was that? Was that an international incident? You know, how do we get justice in that case? And the justice that I have been satisfied to work toward has come through my work as a board member at the Earth Rights International, which is an organization that is based in Washington, D.C. and along the Thai-Burma border and in Lima, Peru, whose work is dedicated to pioneering these cases, legal cases, in U.S. federal court for the human rights and environmental abuses of mining, oil, and gas, and tourism corporations who have a link to the United States who are operating abroad under dubious conditions. And we at Earth Rights have had many victories, including one that we were just celebrating yesterday in Los Angeles, lifting up the end of a 10-year struggle against Occidental Petroleum for a 10-year legal struggle brought by Earth Rights on behalf of a partner organization, Amazon Watch, and five indigenous Peruvian Ashuar communities who have been enduring 35 years of pollution left by Occidental in the Corrientes River Basin there. This case settled recently to the satisfaction of both parties, and we were celebrating that conclusion just this weekend. And that's one of several high-profile international settlements that Earth Rights has been able to pursue by bringing these cases in U.S. federal court under legal theories that are innovative and have a strong basis in our legal traditions here of pursuing justice. So there's not justice in the murders of Terrence and Ingrid and Lahey, but there is justice in many neighboring communities who have suffered immensely at the hands of these corporations. So all of that work, you know, it's work I do right now as a board member of Earth Rights International, but it certainly informs what I'm doing here at the University of California when I talk about us creating circumstances for young people to have the skills to be the knowledge brokers. I am thinking about what does it take to unleash the capacity of more young people to go out into the world and stand with the truth and to stand in our knowledge of what it will take right now to transform our current systems and cultures of our industrial growth society into new systems and cultures of a life-sustaining society. That is an unprecedented agenda, and it is one that is squarely on the shoulders of this generation of young people. And if those of us who are a little bit further along have something to offer, you know, this is the way we're doing that offering right now.
You say that's an unprecedented agenda, and you want the students to stand with the truth, but for the meantime, more of them are going to be going to work for Occidental or similar places than are going to be going to human rights organizations. How are you preparing people for the ones that do go and end up working for those companies? What are the skills that they're taking there?
It's the same skills. It's the same skills. We think of the work, of our work here at the University of California, Irvine, as we're transforming our curriculum across the board to curriculum and co-curricular activity to include climate and sustainability, that we at the University of California train the workforce of California. And the more that the workforce has a sensibility, the more those students have a sensibility of their place in the larger scheme of things, the more likely they will be to position themselves within their organizations to step up and create opportunities for transformational shifts within those entities as well. So it's the same training, and we certainly don't do anything prescriptive with the students about where they end up. You know, we are taking the whole person and creating circumstances for the light to go off, you know, for the light to light up about roles one could play in the world. But we are not prescriptive
that do end up in such places can probably make more change than people that don't.
Oh, I don't know about, I wouldn't, for me, I don't put a weight on it. I think that when one is part of an institution that doesn't identify itself as essential to making the shifts to sustainability and climate neutrality, what is key for that person is the network she or he has outside of the organization, and the strengths of the relationships and the strengths of the experiences she or he has had to inform, you know, taking bold action within contexts that are not inviting it in the first place. You know, we teach people to look for those windows of opportunity.
You're trying to get across all of the students on this campus, and in fact there's similar things happening in the other campuses. Can students avoid it, or is it compulsory in some way?
We cannot make the climate and sustainability curriculum be mandatory on any given campus, because that is a question of academic freedom for the faculty. The intention of making sustainability and climate neutrality part of the curricular and or other educational experience of all UC students by 2020 is an outcome that is defined by faculty from all 10 of our campuses. There's no top-down way to impose that. We're doing that through, voluntary offerings for training and incentives to faculty from any discipline, anybody for whom this work resonates. We want to provide the incentive and training to enable them to incorporate the concepts into their curriculum. But we aren't going to do a top-down
mandate. So academic freedom for the faculty, but the goal is still to get to all the students.
Yeah, and so in the university, we have both education that happens inside the classroom, otherwise known as curriculum, and outside the classroom, which we call here co-curriculum, and that happens through entities on any given campus that are called student affairs offices or student resource centers, that kind of thing. And those offerings, in our 10-campus system, the co-curricular sustainability and climate neutrality education offerings vary greatly. And what we're trying to do now is distribute best practices and enable all of the involved faculty and staff on those campuses to avail of best practices and get it going in a more comprehensive way with all students. But it's a grand experiment. We don't know it. Rolling it out for 250,000 students annually is will be new. People are excited about it. We're not starting from zero for sure. Within the University of California system, we've got some of the highest ranked green campuses in the country, and not just because of carbon footprint of the campus, but because of curricular offerings, research, and student activism. So we're drawing on a rich legacy on all of our campuses for experimenting with taking it to scale.
California is an interesting place, isn't it? It seems kind of progressive, but you're driving big cars all over the place, lots. You're running out of water. And it doesn't seem to have affected anybody.
It depends on who the anybody is.
I'm seeing a lot of lawns being watered.
Well, right here, hyper-locally in Irvine, we use recycled water for the lawns. And that is in an agreement with our water district. And we're in a situation in which the campus is the largest consumer of that recycled water. And we're just in the figuring out stage. It could be that if we change our relationship to, i.e. reduce our consumption of the recycled water, that the whole program goes, and that would affect other users, municipal users of the recycled water too. So we're in that negotiation and assessment process right now. There are the governor's voluntary and mandatory water consumption reduction efforts that are in full effect here. What we like to remind people in California and beyond is that individual water consumption based conservation efforts account for such a small fraction of California's water use. We have industrial agriculture that is in urgent need of reform, self-described urgent need of reform, given the drought and given our understanding of the rate of depletion of the groundwater upon which it depends. And that is a national conversation, given that the breadbasket and the fruit and vegetable cornucopia for the nation is in these desperately dry valleys. There's industrial ag, and then there's also the question of whether it is conceivable for us to say as a state that we are addressing the drought seriously if we don't also look with a critical eye at fracking.
Are the students coming in, do they get this? And is that in the environment that they're living in, where they're quite separated from the environment, yet it's got these quite big blooming things which they can hardly ignore, but they're quite protected from. Like they might live in a desperately dry valley, but somebody else is managing the irrigation. The water's appearing from somewhere. It's quite hard, I think, to take sort of seriously these bigger questions when there are technical fixes, and it kind of leads to a belief that, oh, people are going to solve this, people are clever.
But you know what we find with young people, even those who are not already activated, is that when we ask the right questions, the reflection and introspection is there, the awareness is there, and it doesn't take that much to get it to come to the surface in a student's own words, her or his own analysis of what her or his own community, own family's relationship is to the complex global change issues and how they manifest, you know, for their families and for their in their daily lives. It's right under the surface, even for the unactivated student. And what we are experimenting with in the resource center that the students run here on hyper locally on our campus is, you know, what does it take to awaken that conversation for all 29,000 students on this campus? You know, we have concentrated so far on targeting the students who either through their classes or through their community service projects, you know, are already awakened in some way, and we train them up and get them activated in skillful manners out in the world. For students writ large, we're taking all sorts of approaches to that, mostly through this co-curricular sustainability education. And you know, one innovation, for example, that we're implementing here is that we're creating a campus as a living laboratory internship program so that students can get academic credit for working on applied research projects here on our campus to improve the sustainability and climate neutrality practices of our campus. And that is one way in which we get to tell the story to students about where their water comes from and where their energy comes from and where what impacts their transportation choices have, that kind of thing. But, you know, I've come to the University of California at Irvine after living for many, many years in the San Francisco Bay Area, where the culture is different. And I came here I arrived here in late 2011 and asked the same questions you did, you know, is it in the mind of anybody? And just with a little bit of strategic questioning and good listening, I found the undercurrents of it. And what I'm finding now, 3.5 years later, is that the undercurrent is not so far under. And I feel like we're at, we may be at a tipping point in our conception of ourselves. You know, here at the University of California, Irvine, sustainability has a long legacy. We were founded by faculty members who went on to discover the hole in the ozone layer and went on to go beyond their science to make sure that on the policy side it was being addressed. That work happened here. And we also, you know, have up through to today, our science faculty are producing scholarship that's informing the IPCC reports that's, you know, most recently establishing that glacier melt is irreversible, you know, and the extent to glacier melt now on the poles, are looking deeply at ocean acidification and, you know, the future of our coral reefs. Like a lot of the premier science builds on the founding legacy of this campus 50 years ago in this realm. So we're in a culture shift process here where we are recognizing that legacy for ourselves and teaching it to our students as they themselves step into these shoes.
You say that the founders went beyond their science. Do you think it has now become the science? Can you separate them? Can you say this is the science over here and this is sustainability as something else?
Our purpose of our initiative is to make community-engaged sustainability scholarship and practice integral to UC Irvine's excellence, right? So what that means to us is enabling the faculty to faculty, staff, and students to understand that the role of the scholar and the role of the scientist and the role of the engaged citizen are compatible and complementary, and in fact, arguably in this moment, necessary.
How high up in the mission statement ranking does that fall?
We are in the middle of updating our strategic plan, and the only thing I'll say about it is that when the chancellor goes and travels to speak with alumni in Washington, D.C. or New York City, you know, he's been taking me and my faculty director with him to speak on this.
What's your go-to definition of sustainability?
very loosely go back to Brundtland, but what's more interesting to us right now is we, through our community work, it has arisen that it would be beneficial to anchor a regional climate resilience collaborative here at UC Irvine for our county and counties east of here into the desert. And as we do that work, we're looking at the definition of resilience as being, you know, not an effort regarding bouncing back, but of bouncing forward. And that the key elements of resilience as we see it are not only mitigation and adaptation, but also deep democracy. And the framework that we're engaging in teasing out how that looks programmatically is called the Pathways to Resilience Framework that the Kresge Foundation here in the United States has engaged 40 or so nonprofit and community groups in urban parts of the United States to define. So we're looking here in a California context in which there are 5 existing recognized regional climate collaboratives. We're looking at adding a 6th, because it happens to be that our region is not covered. And our contribution to that statewide network would be to add in this element of deep democracy.
You also say sustainability and climate neutrality. Why does that need to be made explicit?
We are part of the University of California system in which our president, Janet Napolitano, has made a commitment to carbon neutrality by 2025. And the work of our campuses historically over the last decade has hubbed around sustainability. So now we're in this moment where we're weaving together the new focus on a 2025 carbon neutrality goal and the decade worth of work we have done under sustainability rubric. So, and I also like to separate it out because as part of the culture shift, because we are in this moment pre-Paris and in this moment at the federal policy level, the intergovernmental level, the federal policy level, the state policy level, where the grappling with what does it take to decarbonize our economy and our systems and cultures is seeming to be more tangible and digestible than aiming for sustainability goals writ large. The way that we think of the relationship is that, you know, sustainability measures and practices are how we get to climate neutrality on many fronts, or carbon neutrality on many fronts. They're not one and the same.
What you're describing sounds hugely compelling to me. But it's quite a long and complex story. And the opposing story, one the one of consumption and party, is a lot simpler story to tell.
I'll tell it in a simpler way. The story part that we like to tell, this is coming out of the Pathways to Resilience framework, is that if we, what we like to think about is that eco is a word that means home, you know, in Greek. Ecosystems are our relationships of home. Ecology is our study of, or our knowledge of home, or our knowledge of our relationships of home. Economy is the management of home. Our economy, our way of managing home, should reflect our knowledge of our relationships of home. Our fundamental relationships of home are those of interdependence. It is time for our economy to reflect interdependence. It's time for us to do the work of reweaving humanity back into the web of life. And that means a lot of creative work to create the new systems and cultures of a life-sustaining society.
Is it in conflict with the American dream?
The American dream is multifaceted and varied. And it is being constantly redefined. The American dream of white picket fence and every man has his castle, it didn't turn out to work for very many people at all. And the kind of coyote trickster beauty of this moment of ecological transition is that in order to decarbonize, we're talking about distributed power. We're talking about every community coming together to figure out their waste management and their composting and their food production and their water gathering and their energy storage. And when communities need to reorganize that way, it means we need to know each other. We need to talk to each other. We need to get in each other's business. And that is where the personal mastery that we're teaching young people outside of the classroom through our sustainability leadership trainings, you know, is coming in, is showing up as essential training, as communities are in this transition.
Are we going to get this transformation though with a political system that surely can't be described as deep democracy? Do we need that existing system to help us transition to the new one?
The way that we think of it is that there is a spectrum of strengths. People work to change the current systems and cultures of the industrial growth society through actions like service, resistance, governance, reform, and people also dedicate themselves to create new systems and cultures of a life-sustaining society. Transformation happens over time. The most effective communities I have seen of people working on all parts of this spectrum of strengths know their location in that spectrum and are aware of where other people are doing work, so that we don't have a resistance movement, aka, you know, in other words, like folks who are trying to stop the bad stuff, stop the oil company from dumping, or, you know, get reparation when there's been a wrong. We don't have them working in isolation from peers who are, you know, creating new economic systems for Detroit, you know, or for.
Is it radical enough? Did you have an Occupy movement on campus? Did they want you to go further?
I arrived here on this campus right at that moment when I was still doing a lot of listening. And I cannot be the one to answer the question of whether it's radical enough. We do the training to set up young people to know how to ask questions.
What successes have you had in the last couple of years? What's your biggest success?
Well, we are so much in the middle. At the at the community level in April, out in Borrego Springs, California, we had what I would characterize as a moment of success in a long-term process. And that moment was, you know, in our desert research station, in one room, our faculty and graduate students and 20-some leaders from the Borrego Stewardship Council met to take their vision statement and transform it into accountability and responsibility sub-teams in order to make sure that the Stewardship Council is set up for success over the longer term. And in the next room over, we had our students who had been trained through the process I have described, working with 28 high school students from the local area who were 90% children of migrant farm workers, who were having their first introduction to this process I've described of waking up to the ecological and social crises together with peers. You know, it's a conversation that usually exists in a young person's mind in isolation, and we gave the opportunity for it to be a conversation they had together. And to go through a little bit of a taser of training of, you know, how to move from your concern into action. And I call that day a success in a point of success in a long-term process, because one of the outcomes at the end of the day was for the older community members on the Stewardship Council to look with fresh eyes at the power of the youth, and to realize that the young people who had gathered were caring about the same things and had fresh ideas about how their community can address them. And long-standing questions from the elders about, you know, where are our young people? Why aren't they engaged? You know, were answered. And now we have the invitation from the superintendent of that school district to bring our young people from here at UCI to do this process, you know, in the science classroom, which is in the Australian context, for example, one of the key formulas for creating long-term, broad-based, community-driven change processes on environmental and social justice issues. So that's one. Another is that when President Obama came to our campus a year ago this week to deliver a commencement address, he decided he wanted to talk about climate change. So we got to inform his remarks, letting him know very clearly our campus's legacy of leading in this area, and also to help nudge forward the content of his remarks to embrace a more rapid uptake at the federal policy level. So I count that as a success just because it's a moment in which UC Irvine was able to intervene on the national stage. Another upcoming experiment at that level is that we have the honor of hosting His Holiness the Dalai Lama's official world celebration of his 80th birthday, July 5, 6, 7 of this year. And it's the three-day event is called a Global Compassion Summit. The second day of the summit, the morning focuses on climate change. So we have a two-hour window in which the Dalai Lama and select panelists who will be named shortly will be discussing climate change and his vision for what it takes to ignite compassionate action for the planet. So that's been keeping us busy too. And
so Obama, the Pope, and the Dalai Lama seem to get it. Do you think we're getting there?
I myself don't keep a close tab on those metrics in the big, at the programmatic level, I do, but not as the, at the are we getting there level. What drives me more than that question is a sensibility that I carry and that our staff, faculty and community partners embrace, which is that there are ways to walk in the world that are characterized by right action, and you do it without a stickiness around the outcome. We're not going to not do this work. We're not going to just let it go to hell in a handbasket right now. You know, we're not. That's not an option. We are doing this work, as I characterized at the beginning, from a place of joy and integrity so that we can be here for the long haul, no matter what the long haul brings. Our understanding is that if we do this work right now, we are developing the strength of relationship and of interbeing that we will need to call on later if we move toward, you know, as systems move toward collapse. And I speak of collapse freely in this interview because we are in the context of a meeting here at the University of California, Irvine, right now, in which the information technology scholars in the room, several of them, are asking at the academic and activist level, you know, what is the role of IT in preparing society for collapse or as we move into systems collapse?
Okay, I've got five questions to get through quickly to answer. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I am a lifelong activist, yes.
What motivates you?
I am here on this planet. I am alive. I am lucky enough not to have had my life taken already for this work. There are plenty of other people who are similarly motivated, whose lives have been taken. If I am still here, the only work worth doing is work that enables people to have the space to live in freedom and live in right relationship that they define to their food, water, and earth.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Well, this challenge of making sustainability and carbon neutrality part of the educational experience of all UC students by 2020, that's an aggressive target with lots of moving parts that is exciting to me because of the level of faculty engagement throughout the 10 campuses on it. And I also like this challenge because it can provide a blueprint for how we do that nationally, internationally. The other challenge I am eager to take on is how we integrate the north-south, south-north solidarity work we are doing into our international development studies and, you know, co-curricular opportunities for students, how we develop using the research, teaching, and service resources of the campus to make sure that we are developing a critical lens on that local global solidarity and deepening students' understanding of the interdependence of all life. Like, it is not obvious how we do that, but I'm engaged very heavily in that challenge right now.
Two more. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur by the time you wake up tomorrow morning, what would that be?
Magic wand waved tomorrow morning. We are in authentic, engaged dialogue with our communities as neighbors, as municipalities, as regional governments, state, national, intergovernmental. The shift that I'm most interested in is what happens when we are doing the hard work of building community right where we are to accelerate the shifts we need to see.
And lastly, do you have any advice for listeners?
I'm not one to give advice. The perspective I would like to invite listeners to entertain is, how would your life be different if you truly believed that you belonged in the web of life? If you truly believed that humanity were part of the web of life, and that, how would your actions be different if you saw that you were held a critical role in the web of life to reweave humanity back in?
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Abby Reyes, who is the Director of Sustainability, the Sustainability Initiative at the University of California, Irvine. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook to keep in touch, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.